Good morning, diners and travelers of the world. You're listening, as usual, I'm hoping, to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
And it's a special day.
It is a special day. It is a special year.
We're trying
to remember, I think it's 6 years.
I can't remember if it's 5 or 6 that On the Menu's been going.
But whatever it is,
we're just so looking forward to another wonderful year with you. And to get us off to a flying start for 2008, what could be better than a book all about desserts? So we don't have nearly as many dessert cookbooks on the show as we should, so we're trying to make up for it in the beginning of the new year by setting off to a flying start with a wonderful book called Lost Desserts, and the author,
Gail Monahan.
Well,
these aren't just
Monahan desserts,
yeah. Hey,
well, they're lost desserts, but we're going to get into that.
Gail, you're talking about the classic lost desserts. I mean, these are desserts that they're memorable and should not be forgotten, right?
Well, yes. I mean, most of them are lost classic desserts, although there's some more rare cherché, more esoteric desserts in the book, too, and a few home desserts. So many of them are grand and sort of show-stopping desserts, you know, that when you bring them as a finale to a dinner, they impress the guests. Although they're easy to make, they're very impressive. But some of them are homier. I mean, it's a mixture. It's a mixture. It's mostly that they're just not so well-known anymore.
Now, how did you started out writing an article, right?
Yes. Initially, I had brought my very favorite dessert in the world, which is the Blum's Coffee Crunch Cake, because it's something I remember from my trials in Los Angeles. I brought this dessert to a birthday dinner. I was asked to bring a birthday cake of an editor at the now-defunct House & Garden, but at that point, House & Garden was going strong. And I brought this cake to dinner, and everybody loved it. And somehow, Blum's by then was closed. And we started talking about desserts that were no more and desserts in Los Angeles. And people got excited, and we decided to do a Lost. There were many other House & Garden staff members at the dinner. So we decided right there and then, they signed me up to do an article on Los Angeles lost desserts, which I did, and which was pretty easy because I remembered them. You know, I grew up with them.
Uh-huh.
And the article, I think, probably because there was a fabulous photographer, and House & Garden threw a huge amount of money at him. So it was just a gorgeous, gorgeous article. So therefore, it was popular, and it got some attention. And it was decided that, you know, this shouldn't just be an article, it should be a book. So from there, it became a book, but it was a slow process. I mean, it was a lot of research, a lot of doing.
How long did it take you researching?
Well, I mean, the real work, I mean, it was hard work for a year and a half, which is understandable, but it was 2 or 3 years before that I signed up to do it, but I managed to get divorced in the middle, and I spent 2 years in Europe, which actually turned out to be great.
That's great, yeah.
It was good because in the end, even though I took a trunk load of books to Europe that I then never opened the trunk, but I bought all kinds of books, I talked to all kinds of people, I found all kinds of, you know, books that you buy by the sen and books that you buy by the tens, you know, all these weird old books.
Oh, yeah.
So in the end, although it wasn't real research, you know, having that time for the ideas to gestate in my head were really good, and then I came back, and it took about a year and a half to actually do the research, write the book, test the recipes, you know. And
now, what was your criteria?
For being lost?
Yes.
Well, first of all,
for being lost and worthy of inclusion in this book.
Right, all right. So, first of all, as my fabulous photographer, Eric Bowman, who did the great photographs in the book, said, he said, look, Gail, you've got to remember these desserts are lost, but they have to be worthy of bringing back. So that was the major criterion, is, you know, they were out of favor, but they had to be delicious, they had to be makeable, they, you know, people in, you know, 2007 had to like them, now 2008. So that was the first thing. And then after that, Rizzoli also wanted a narrative-driven book, so it also had to be desserts that there was something to say about it. I mean, each dessert has a story attached to it, or an anecdote, or, you know, a large header. So that there, I don't remember what they were now, but there were a number of desserts that were delicious, but that I really didn't have much to say about, and those weren't included.
And yeah, your story, that side of it, really rolls along. I mean, you just keep, it's like the page turner of cookbooks.
Well, thank you. People have told me they really like reading it, which I don't know why.
I did. I mean, I don't bake at all. I guess I read the whole thing.
No, it's a wonderful storybook.
Oh, I'm so
really
glad
is.
Because, you know, that information was so interesting to me, and I really loved doing, I didn't expect to love doing the research, and then I did love doing the research. But, you know, I got so enmeshed in my own research that I really couldn't tell anymore if this information was interesting in general or just interesting to me.
Oh,
but
I thought
people,
it was. I thought it was.
Like it.
I thought it was great. It seems that pastry chefs are quite extraordinary bunch.
Yeah, it was really an interesting bunch of people I found out about. You know, Carême and Escoffier.
Oh yeah, they're good people. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was really. I mean, once I got into it, the research was fascinating.
See, we could actually have lengthy discussions about all of these desserts in here. I'm looking at this Escoffier's Mont Blanc, and I've never seen a picture that looked like that. It looks like it's on spaghetti, whipped cream on spaghetti.
Well, that's what Mont Blanc is. Often they're smaller, but it's still looking like spaghetti, because what Mont Blanc is that you're putting a sugared chestnut puree, essentially, through a ricer. And when you put it, I mean, that is okay. What the dessert is.
Yeah, that's what it would look like.
No, and that is traditional Mont Blanc is put through a ricer. That's what it is. And so sometimes it's on a little meringue shell, sometimes it's not, but it always has the whipped cream because that's the snow, the Mont Blanc, the mountain peak.
Right.
Why don't we do the story of how the Bomb Alaska got its name?
The Baked Alaska?
I mean, you used to tell that as a Bomb Alaska, but before that it was called something else.
Well, originally, I mean, the dessert existed in certainly the 1900s, if not the 1800s, but it had different names like Omelette Norwegienne and Omelette en Surprise. But then at Delmonico's, it was Delmonico's in New York. I think it was Charlie Ranhofer, the chef, invented this dessert for, I think it was the purchase of Alaska by the United States. So something to do with Alaska becoming a state. It was about Alaska. And he named the dessert originally, he called it Alaska Florida, which nobody has said this, but I suppose it was because the raison d'etre of Baked Alaska is the cold ice cream inside and the warm cake and meringue on the outside. So I guess the cold with the hot was like, the snow with Florida. But very soon, Alaska, Florida sounded sort of stupid, and then the name got changed to Baked Alaska.
No kidding. See, the same dessert in my native land is called Bomb Vesuvius.
Bomb Vesuvius. And is that because, do you light it? Is it because
That's because you light it, and it's a miracle. It's an even more of a miracle that the ice cream doesn't melt because
you
light it, too.
Yeah, you now have all the flaming liquor running onto the meringue.
Exactly.
Yeah, your cousin makes that, Michael.
Yeah, of all things, my cousin Michael, who's a career engineer, makes it. But what you don't know is that was one of the few things that the St. Catherine's Cambridge College kitchen knew how to make. When they actually chose to cook instead of choosing to poison the undergraduates, they could actually do something.
Did they use vanilla ice cream or did they use something else inside?
No, well, there was a lot of fruit as well inside.
Yes,
so
it was the same
concept as the Bomb Alaska with the fruit meeting the ice cream meeting the meringue that made it so special.
Yes, there was one of the original recipes I remember reading back from the 1900s had vanilla ice cream and I think fruit, maybe with some liquor or something on top of that, and then the meringue on top of that.
I think that would be to me a classic Bomb Vesuvius.
Yeah, and I think that was a classic early Baked Alaska. That it was that combination, and then people started making it with other kinds of ice cream. I really like it with coffee ice cream. My mother used to make it with lemon custard ice cream.
Oh, geez.
Now you have
to. But my mother did what you're saying. My mother had that little half an eggshell on top, filled with, I suppose, brandy.
Oh, okay.
She then lit.
Now, I just told Peter a little bit ago, I read somewhere, and I can't remember where, that one of these experimental chefs produced at some major conference this Baked Alaska Inside Out, where the inside was frozen and the outside was hot.
Now that sounds kind of silly. I mean, it sort of
Wait a minute.
It's inside out, what he did.
So you're saying somehow it had ice cream on the outside.
Yes. How did he do that?
And he still managed to cook it.
That's a weird one.
Yeah, I think molecular gastronomy,
What was Wiley Dufresne trying to do with ice cream?
He was trying to do warm ice cream.
And what does that mean?
That's a good question.
I wonder what that is.
He couldn't quite explain it. He had somebody from an ice cream company who was helping him to try to make it. We could not quite figure out what he was trying to create.
Well, wasn't it Ferran Adria started out trying to figure out how to freeze steam?
My
book is sort of the opposite of all those concepts. Straightforward desserts. Big desserts, you cut up, you share them, it's community, you bring it together. It's not about anything like that. Sort of the opposite. Although I think that's fascinating, this book is the opposite of that.
But you must give us. There's a half a secret in your book. The other half of the secret is what I want, because I just don't know. You said that at least one dessert didn't make it in there because you never could figure out how to make it, and it's called Indian pudding. Now, I don't have the slightest idea what Indian pudding is. Can you help?
Oh yeah, let me try to remember. It was because I made it several times. It was cornmeal, and I think molasses. and probably eggs. And it's something that the, you know, people ate it at Thanksgiving. It was some recipe that, you know, an early pilgrim recipe.
Oh, okay. All
and
right.
It's served with hard sauce, and it's one of the, and it's good. It's very heavy. It's very puddingy. I mean, it's kind of like sticky toffee pudding, but with a different flavor.
And that's in there, too, in case anybody longs for that.
That's sort of like, it's sort of like the suet puddings that my mother used to make that you said you didn't include because they weren't any good. And that was another category.
She didn't like
that. Was another category of lost desserts that didn't make it.
Right, it didn't make it. And again, the book, the choosing of which desserts were in and not in the book, it was a very personal, it's a personal book, and they're personal choices, and I just happened to... Something about suet, cooking with suet, doesn't appeal to me at all.
That's all that they use. They all cook with suet. I mean, I asked you about the original mincemeat was all made with real meat and suet.
Right, as was Spotted Dick was made with suet. Most of those steamed puddings were made with suet. Apple Hat is made with suet. I mean, there were huge numbers of those puddings that I just, somehow the idea of steamed pudding, I just couldn't see that many people making it today and that many people using suet.
No,
I mean,
I'm sure you're absolutely right.
But I mean, people love it. It's not just you. You know, people love those old-fashioned puddings.
I only love it nostalgically.
Well, yeah. It's true.
You like lardo in Italy. It's not sweet.
But that's not dessert.
Yeah, see, I like lardo, but I don't put it in dessert, right? Right.
Well, let's move on here.
I have another question.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why cassata siciliana is lost, because it's not.
Well, I guess for me... Yeah, it seemed lost to me. I mean, the cassata siciliana like that, I don't see much in this country.
Well,
I never got
it much in this country.
You know, I guess in Naples around Easter, you're certainly going to get it, and you're going to get it in Italy. But it seemed pretty lost to me here. That was one of the personal ones where I wanted to use it, and I thought it was beautiful, and I thought not that many people here really know about it.
You see, and that would make a great cover, that photo.
Well, we're not going to discuss that.
But I think that would be a great cover. I just read a whole novel, by the way, about somebody touring Sicily because he wanted to do a piece on cassata.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, do you know about that?
No. No, yeah. Who wrote it, do you know?
It was somebody, he's not very good. The language was not very good. The concept was all right.
We don't think it's a book we probably won't interview the author of. Yeah. We probably won't recommend.
I mean, trained as a writer, as you are, you would cringe reading the language.
But you're saying the information was interesting.
The information was interesting.
So did he find all different kinds of cassata?
No, he had to wait. Of course, the great denouement was a confirmation ceremony where they brought out, finally, he got his cassata.
There's another cassata that's frozen. There's an, you know, called, what's it called? I don't know. I feel like it's called cassata siciliana also, or almost the same name. That's a frozen... It's sort of got the same ingredients like the candied fruit and those kinds of things, but it's a bomb that you unmold. But was his that, or was his more of a cake, or could you not tell?
No, it was the spunded cake with everything on it, like the glacé fruits and everything.
Right, so similar to my idea. It wasn't a dessert.
No.
I mean, that was a dessert, and it wasn't an ice cream dessert.
Right. But I don't know. I was raised Sicilian, so this is not a lost dessert to me.
But to you, it's not lost at all.
Now, Peter has this marked. Do you have Carême's... souffle.
Oh, I thought it was interesting that you considered it a lost, but the history of being able to make a souffle I thought was interesting, and you talked about the fact that up until a certain point, a souffle wasn't something you would even be able to make.
No, they changed the way the ovens worked, and the heat was convected differently, and at that point people could make souffles. And the original souffles were made in hard pastry cases that were not eaten, which became the models for using, you know, a little ceramic souffle mold, which obviously isn't eaten either, but it used to be made in a hard pastry case that wasn't eaten.
Yeah, so that kind of thing is fascinating. We were at a restaurant recently which had an interior elevator between the kitchen and the first floor, and the chef owned up to us that souffles don't like elevators.
Yeah.
Well, I think that they wouldn't like elevators, but they probably also wouldn't like the amount of time it took.
No.
You know what?
I think
about the time than the elevator.
I think that was the point he was making.
I mean, they pride themselves in being able to run these chocolate souffles up and down.
Well, because it's predictable. Besides, they have appropriate slaves to be able to run them up and downstairs.
One other thing I need to mention. I could talk to you forever, by the way, Gail. Under this souffle Rothschild, you refer to what... Talk about lost. The Vincent Price cookbook.
Oh, such a divine cookbook.
Isn't it? And I mean, that's been on a print for years. my famous mushroom soup started out with a recipe from that cookbook.
Yeah, she still has it.
Which is, I mean, I've modified it, of course. But
as one does over the years.
Yeah, but it's now it's wild mushroom. But it contains the secret ingredient, which is a couple tablespoons of sweet Italian vermouth.
How interesting.
Yeah.
And you probably can't taste it, but you can taste something and you probably don't know what it is.
That was fabulous. That's
exactly right. That's exactly what it does.
Do you have this cookbook?
I do have that cookbook. And I've had it forever. Can you remember what restaurant it came from? You probably don't, but it's like all the recipes in that book are, you know, from all these different restaurants.
No, I don't remember.
I'll look. After we get off the phone with this, I will.
You will find out.
I'll go look. Yeah, because now I'm curious. So
yeah.
the vermouth wasn't your addition, though. So if I go look at the recipe, the vermouth is in there.
It's in there, yeah. I've changed it from to wild mushrooms in the proportions.
No, which is probably better, more flavorful.
Oh, it's great. Yeah.
Mm. Well, Gail, what are some of your favorites?
In the book?
In the book.
Well, as I've said, I love the coffee crunch cake. That, without doubt, it's probably my favorite cake in the world. Maybe my favorite dessert in the book, maybe even more than the coffee crunch cake, is the fanet, which is a crazy concoction of... It's so elaborate, it's so baroque, and so easy to make. You line a mold with vanilla ice cream, and you have ready some whipped cream, and some crunched up hard meringue. I mean, you could even buy the meringue, you know, at a bakery, but crunched up hard meringue in big chunks, chocolate shavings, and some chopped up white nougat. And so you have this shell of vanilla ice cream in your freezer, which can be there for several days. When you, about 2 hours or 3 hours before you want to eat, you fold some of the whipped cream in with the nougat, and you line, you know, you fill the middle of the void in the middle of this ice cream, and you freeze it, but it only gets partially frozen. So then when you're ready to serve it, you unmold it, you put more whipped cream on the outside, like as an icing, you stick all kinds of meringue chunks on top and chocolate shavings on top of that. It is so divine. I mean, it doesn't sound that divine, but it's the best.
It sounds all over the top, actually.
This is the one that you ate somewhere in France, and then you asked them for the recipe, and they said, we don't have it.
Oh, it was the craziest thing.
So then you made it up and sent it back.
Yes, and now she, the Comtesse de Vogue, which is where I had it, this woman, I mean, a cousin of, I was really lucky, a friend of mine's cousin owns this amazing chateau, and a famous chateau in France. And we were there over a few days over New Year's Eve once, and we had this dessert, and she told me how to make it, and I wrote it all down. And then she couldn't remember, and so in the end, they made it, they love it, and she's including it. Christina, the Countess, is including it in her book on Vaux desserts. It's going to come. Flammarion is coming out with it next spring.
Oh,
it was a very funny story. And I had tea with her in Paris just a couple of weeks ago, and she still couldn't remember. She still said, we love it, it's delicious, but I can't remember.
Now, tell me about the mystique of this. Is it the canalis?
Oh, the canale.
A canale, is it? I couldn't figure out where the accent was.
They're so delicious.
Oh, here it is. Okay,
they're
accent.
So delicious. They come, I guess they were invented a long time ago, I think hundreds of years ago, in a... In a nunnery. I would say a monastery, but I think it's a nunnery in Bordeaux. And they're in. You make them in these little kind of individual portion size, heavy copper fluted molds. And it's sort of like a sweet rum flavored Yorkshire pudding in a way, but richer and sweeter. But they get very, very sugar caramelized on the outside, and they're heavy. I mean, they're just divine. I've never had anything like them, and they're very eggy, you know, very rummy. I mean, they're just really the caramelized sugar. They're just delicious.
How easy to make! I'd like to try those, but I don't have those molds.
Yeah, you need the molds. They're unbelievably easy to make if you have the molds.
I've seen the molds advertised.
Yeah, if you have the molds, you then just make batter. It's essentially a batter, like a pancake batter almost, and you leave it. I think it has to rest. I think it's overnight in the refrigerator,
like,
and you can
Yorkshire
keep
pudding.
It in the refrigerator like a week. So then you can just fill them up and make them whenever you want. I mean, it's easy if you have the molds.
So you have a cannoli mold yourself.
Oh, I have a dozen of these little molds, so I can feed
Did
a dozen.
Did you buy them new or in a flea market?
I bought them new. I started out buying two because they are expensive, thinking I would sort of, you could make two at a time, but they were so delicious and such a pain to make two at a time that I just, you know, sprung for it and bought a dozen of them, and I love them. But they are expensive, and if you don't get the heavy copper ones, which you can get other kinds, but they really need that heavy copper to get the sugar to caramelize properly.
Yeah, well, listen, listeners, since you're already over your New Year resolution about weight, this has been a program that will get your year off to a great start. Gail. We thank you so much for joining us and talking with us so enthusiastically about this absolutely delightful book called Lost Desserts. You can buy it through onthemenuradio.com and OTM Bookshelf if you'd like to, just for your convenience. It's there. We thank you, Gail. We wish you a happy and a prosperous 2008, and let us know if you're working on another interesting project.
Oh, great. I mean, thank you so much for having me. Happy New Year to all of you. And I do have two more books, you know, beginning to be in the works. I'm hoping to do two in the next few, you know, 2 or 3 years.
That'd be wonderful. So we'll look forward to seeing them, and we'll look forward to sharing them with listeners. And now I think it's time to
take a break.
So we'll do that.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gail.
Bye, Gail.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. I think I've said good morning already, but I'll say again, good morning,
Peter.
Yeah,
Peter's still here.
Yeah, don't forget, email us. Email Peter so he feels good. it's on
yeah,
the
I mean,
menu.
I just sit here behind a recorder. Sometimes I don't even have a word to say.
Well, you do, but on the menu at onthemenuradio.com, and give us your ideas and reactions and so forth. Positive criticism is always welcome.
And here we are, searching the planet once again for the very best, very most interesting ingredients. And we found a really surprising one in the mountain state of Colorado. And Jules Silver is joining us on the program, and I'll get him to explain his enterprise. And
Jules is the sauce master, but he's also the owner, an inventor, and just about everything. Is that correct, Jules?
I sweep the floors. I pack, we ship, we do everything that is gourmet and specialty.
Now, explain to us, you have a company called Marzana Brand Foods. Then you have the sauce, the
Club Sauce.
Club Sauce. And then you have the Splash label.
Right.
Could you just walk us through what all these entities do?
Sure. Well, from the beginning, 1991, I started with Club Sauce. The name came from a takeoff of Club Med. What we tried to do was to put gift sets together on a monthly basis that people would sign up for. Ultimately, it just converted over to a gourmet and specialty website, which I've maintained for a number of years, selling things like demi-glace and stocks and olive oils.
Hey, demi-glace is useful. You mean you don't sell that anymore?
No. I still do. Club Sauce is probably the largest internet supplier of demi-glace and stocks made by More Than Gourmet,
I see.
Which is recognized as one of the top commercial brands.
Wow.
But we've also expanded, as I say, into saffron. We get our saffron from Iran, which makes the best in the world. Top quality olive oils from Italy and balsamic vinegars and so on and so forth. But I've always played around in cooking. I'm not a trained chef. Several years ago, I was enamored with a product that I found on the market, which was a pomegranate reduction with Merlot wine. And the person who was making it went out of business. And I tried to capture the recipe. We couldn't come to an agreement, so I decided, well, I'll go off on my own and create a new product line. And that's how I came up with Marzana Brand.
Now, I think for our full disclosure now, let us know when you actually leave your real day job of the past, which was investment broker or banker.
Yeah.
When was that?
Well, you know, it's been a slow migration since 91.
Okay.
Basically, I do have a few clients that I still deal with that are institutional kind of clients, which is probably 5% of my time. And you know, anywhere from a 60 to 80-hour work week. I just love writing articles and putting information on my website, my newsletters, et cetera, about the products that I carry and, of course, my new baby, this Marzana Brand Foods, which, by the way, is a combination of my two granddaughters' names. One is Marlia and one is Zana.
Oh,
so that's how
names.
We came up with Marzana.
Uh-huh.
And it has taken off from the beginning. I experimented for about 3 years trying to find the appropriate pomegranate, because unbeknownst to me, there are a number of varieties that have quite a difference in flavor. The one that we settled on comes from the Middle East, comes from Lebanon, and of course was pretty much in the area where pomegranate was first discovered and used some 3,000 years ago.
Yeah, some people think that the apple in the Garden of Eden was actually a pomegranate.
Well, you beat me to the punch. That's exactly what I was going to say.
Oh, that's because of all the seeds.
Well, isn't it colloquially called a love apple?
It's called a love apple in different countries. The apple is the more common name. But yes, that is one of them. But it's got a lot of mystery behind it, a lot of myth. It's been a medicine. It's been a major symbol in art. Everything from, I just found this out recently, that Jesus was even portrayed holding a pomegranate.
Well, I know that the infant Jesus was.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's all through art history and iconography, the pomegranate.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now you get this.
It's also supposedly an aphrodisiac.
Yes,
you
it
know,
is.
I'm an aficionado of pomegranates.
Yes.
I love
yes.
it.
Well, you know, scientists today are saying that it helps fight cancer. It's, there just are a tremendous amount of benefits, aging and so on and so forth, from pomegranate. I think one of the unfortunate things, though, that happens is that once people hear pomegranate, everybody wants to jump into the production, and a lot of sugar gets added and a lot of other ingredients, which kind of distorts the actual flavor of pomegranate.
Well, now, so you wouldn't call the things you add distorting. You would say improve.
No. Actually, I do not include more than two or three ingredients in any of my pomegranates. Basically, it is pomegranate molasses. That means it comes to us in a somewhat reduced form, but no sugar has been added. Whatever it is, it's just natural. So it's got that tart, sweet flavor. We combine it with various wines and then reduce it down again, and then that becomes our sauce. Well, we took it to another point where we added some additional natural flavors, because pomegranate was such a workable base to create a variety of sauces.
Yeah, that's this, like the tart cherry. None of these have I tasted.
No, well, you have to. I got to tell you, they are fantastic. In fact, I was at a recent show, and we mixed soy sauce, the pomegranate port reduction, and a little bit of the wasabi, and made a sauce for sushi, and I've got to tell you, it was fantastic.
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, that sounds good. We just have the one bottle of the pomegranate port reduction.
Well, I wanted to give you a teaser, see?
You certainly teased me.
Listen, Jules, hold your breath when I tell you. I mean, if Peter has tried it on ice cream, that's fine. He actually made it as a sauce for the liver.
Well, I have to tell you that, you know, as funny as it may sound, it is the perfect fruit for infusing flavor on just about anything.
Well,
this is
the concept, right? I mean, this is why you call it Splash. It even comes in a bottle with the label with splashes on it already.
Exactly, and that I'm also proud of, because I didn't know who to go to help design the label. I knew the look that I wanted.
It's a cool label.
It was my son who helped me long distance from New Jersey. He's in film editing. And he woke up with an epiphany one night and sat up from 3 o'clock in the morning to whatever, and he designed this label for me. And I have been excited about it. It gets very good reviews, and we're really excited
about this whole line. And you told me off air that you're experimenting with all kinds of different products now.
Yes, actually, just to kind of whet your appetite, one that we plan to come out with in January will be a plum sake pomegranate sauce.
Oh, wow.
Which will be fabulous. I mean, I've already
tasted it. Hey, I need to get on your mailing list for sure.
Yes. We also have a chocolate pomegranate sauce that we're, and port wine that we're experimenting with.
Oh, wow.
And the last one...
Well, I'm a good beta tester, if you're interested.
Oh, you are. Well, very good. I'll be more than happy to send them to you. I'll tell you something. Nothing has been more exciting in this business is to allow somebody to taste something that you've created and watch the expression on their face.
Yeah.
Well, let's do this, Jules. You could start with either savory or sweet. Why don't you go through a couple of... recipe combinations that you think are particularly good?
All right. Well, I could run down a whole list, but let me tell you how I started in the beginning. I love, in the summer, fresh berries. So what I did was I would take a combination of blueberry, blackberry, and strawberries. I would toss them with about two, depending on the number I was serving, say four people, I would put 4 tablespoons of the pomegranate port with the berries. I would toss it and then refrigerate it for a couple of hours.
Yeah, I think that's my standard dessert.
Right. Then if you take that, put it in the individual plates, take a spoonful of mascarpone cheese, put that on top.
Oh, that's good.
And then drizzle the remaining sauce. I'm sorry, splash the remaining sauce on top and serve. And I've got to tell you, it's fabulous. You can even touch it off with a mint leaf or two. It's very good.
How about the website is www.clubsauce.com?
That is correct. I do not have a website built for Marzana yet, but when I do, it will just be an informational site for all purchases and information. It will really just kind of forward you over to Club Sauce.
Okay.
Now, if you go on Club Sauce now, in the recipe section, there's a beautiful pork loin recipe there that using also the pomegranate. And by the way, I might mention that all of the sauces are interchangeable. So whatever recipe that you see, it really depends on the kind of flavor that you want to impart. For instance, if I was doing lamb, I would use the Mission Fig pomegranate sauce. If I was poaching pears, for instance, I would use the pomegranate and port, or the tart cherry works really well. If I was serving cheesecake, I could use any one of them. They work fabulous with that. If I was serving ice cream, it would just depend on the flavor. And one of my favorite things, this was a recent discovery, was if I take 1/3 of rice wine vinegar and I mix it with 2/3 of the pomegranate, any flavor, add a little crushed pepper, and use it as a salad dressing. You don't even need oil.
Good. Well, you know, you sound like a good cook, not only a great inventor, but a good cook.
Well,
and I hope you put some of these recipes on.
It is the most fun that I've ever had in my life.
Well, you sound like you're having fun. And I hope everybody checks out your website, keeps checking it as you devise these recipes. I hope the products, and I hope the recipes go on there, too.
They will.
And do a newsletter. Sign us up for the newsletter.
Yes, actually, sign up for the newsletter because... oftentimes I run specials that are just for the people who register for that newsletter. But
well, this has been fun talking to you. And listeners, this man is not only a happy man, but he's a nice man.
Now,
Peter has one more question.
Well, we have to talk about how you get the product through distribution, or you have to order it online, or how does it work?
Well, right now it is just online at www.clubsauce.com. It's in our featured product category. They're all listed there. I do have, if for your listeners who may be in Texas, I'll be in Central Market at about the middle of January. They are really thrilled with the sauce. They want me to come down and do maybe some cooking in their stores with some of their top chefs. I can't mention the names, but there are a number of other top stores that it will be in, I think, by the middle of the year at the latest. But again, you can order it online from me, and we do ship usually within 24 hours on any given business day.
And you're going gangbusters and
I'll
having a great time.
I can't wait to bring out the other products because they're going to be so much fun.
Well, Jules, I can't wait either, Jules. And I hope we get to meet at one of these big food
fairs. I hope so. Actually, if any of your listeners or if you are going to be at the Fancy Food Show in San Diego, we'll have a booth there in January, and we hopefully will make the one in New York.
Yeah, we'll be
July.
In New York for sure.
Yeah,
very good.
We'll see you in New York, and we'll get an update about your product line. Jules, thank you so much for joining us. I sense a splash of pomegranate port reduction in the leftover turkey gravy with dinner tonight.
Yeah, I have to tell you, you hit it right on the head. That's
right
great.
Here.
Jules, thank you so much for
thank
joining
you.
Us. Have
I
a great day.
It.
Thanks,
yes,
Jules. Bye.
Bye-bye.
It's time to take a break.
Is it time to take a break already? Boy, time flies when you're having fun.
Yes.
Listeners, we'll see you back on the other side.
Thank you. Enjoy.
Bye, Jules.
Yes, bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Peter.
Yeah, we're back again, all together. Shall we see something? All together again, and we have a very interesting guest.
First of all, let me bring up the fact that we live for email, so let me pass along that address, which is on the menu at onthemenuradio.com,
and
send us greetings.
And, of course, everything about what we do is at www.onthemenuradio.com, and, of course, we're creating new sound files, new programs for you to listen to today.
Now, I'm going to introduce you to James S. Jackson, who is a geologist who lives in, is it Marin? Hello?
Hello.
You still there?
This is Jim Jackson.
Yes, and you live in California?
No, I live in Portland, Oregon, but we're visiting friends in California.
Oh, okay, so that's the California connection.
Right.
Okay, and the book that I'm holding on my lap is called America from the Air, A Guide to the Landscape Along Your Route. And as I told you off air, Peter's going to do most of this interview because I look out the window and I see abstract paintings. So I make everything into an abstract painting. And the other thing I guess I didn't tell you is my one close call with scenery from the air was in Australia in a six-seater out back where the pilot, who happened to be covered with burn scars, which is another story, would fly us in as close as possible to an exposed rock, which Peter would then identify as primary, secondary, or tertiary, and I sat with my heart in my throat the whole time.
they have some wonderful mesa-like, butte and mesa-type landforms in northern South Australia, which is where we were going at the time. And so Anne would look out the window and say, oh, doesn't that look interesting? And I think Clive was the name of the pilot.
Clive.
So Clive would bank the plane and take us close to this landform so we could inspect it more closely. So we didn't have a book called America from the Air, but we did have Clive who was showing it to us live. And it was really a rather...
It was scary, isn't it?
For me, it was a fascinating experience because you and I have something in common.
Yeah, identify yourself. You're a geographer.
Well, since our listeners know, if they read our homepage, that I have a master's in geography from the University of Cambridge, and I know just a little bit about the geography of the world, although pre-global warming and all that kind of stuff. But we're not going to talk about that because we're going to talk about something different to do while you're on the airplane. Jim, how did you and your colleague come up with idea for this really rather unique book?
Well, I had this idea in 1979.
Holy Moses.
I received my master's degree in 1978, and in the 3 years I was in grad school, I didn't fly at all. I drove back and forth to outcrops and went on field trips, drove across the country several times. My parents lived in D.C. at that time, and I was living in Portland. And then I took a job with an oil company and was living in Texas. And in April of 79, I went to D.C. to visit my parents and my grandfather. And it was really the first time I'd been in an airplane in 4 or 5 years. And that particular flight left Dallas. It headed east. It went over Atlanta. And, you know, it was fascinating to see these things from the air that I had been studying for 3 years, going on 4 years. And then we made a left turn just past Atlanta, and on the ground was one of these very large folded rock structures, you know, something that was 6 miles long and probably 3 miles across, a great Appalachian fold. And I said to myself, well, that's just like you see it in the textbook. This is wonderful. I've learned something. I see something new. And then my next thought was, but wait a minute, what are those rocks? What's their age? When did this fold occur? Oh, there are mines down there. What kind of mining is that? And I realized that I had this training in the interpretation of landforms, you know, the landscape as we see it. But there was so much detail that I didn't have that I really wanted a book that, or a map that I could carry with me to identify specific features.
Well, you better describe. I mean, we have the book here, but listeners need to know what it is in this book that we're looking at.
Well, the book is meant to be about the size of something that would slip into the seat back pocket on an airplane. So it's about 9 inches by about six. The first few pages consist of maps. These are topographic maps. And, you know, they have texture indicating mountain ranges and such. And on the maps, we have most of the major cities in the United States and some in Canada. And imposed on that, we have the routes that commercial flights take. And these are what we think to be the actual routes. We've gone to the FAA maps of high-altitude flight paths. And on those maps, we have compiled, for each of the 40 most popular routes in the U.S., we've compiled a frequency of use of a particular route. You know, for example, from Los Angeles to New York, there are several ways a plane could go, and we wanted to know which one the planes took most often. And so from this compiled map, we've made these page maps, which really show you where you can expect the plane to go most of the time.
Now, what lies underneath that, though, Jim, is a set of aerial photographs, correct?
Right. And beyond the first few pages, we have 150 entries. And each entry consists of an image, many taken from commercial airliners, a number taken from various federal programs of aerial imagery. And they are taken on a scale so that you're seeing things approximately as you would see them from 30 or 35,000 feet. So you should be able to recognize things on the ground based on what you see on the page.
Okay, and then you explain what it is people are seeing. Right? You explain the cities and the landforms that they're actually seeing.
Right. Facing each image, we have a 600 to 800 word essay. And if the topic is center pivot irrigation, those big crop circles you see in the west, then we try to tell you what center pivot irrigation does and when it was first instituted and where it operates.
So it's a really most unusual guidebook, but it is a guidebook.
It is a guidebook, right. In fact, the original title was a guidebook, you know, Field Guide to Air Travel. But, you know, we thought about this for a while and talked to our editor, and we felt that America from the Air, A Guide to the Landscape Along Your Route, really told the prospective reader what we were trying to do.
But you did something beyond that as well. This is not just a book. There's something else inside the back cover.
In the back cover, we have a CD-ROM. So if you don't want to take the book and you do tend to take a laptop, you can put the CD-ROM into your laptop. And when you open the CD-ROM up, you get a PDF, an Acrobat reader file. And you open up the bookmarks, and you'll see each chapter of the book. The book is divided into chapters, which are really flight corridors, and two maps. And if you go to the maps, you will find that there are numbers on the maps, and if you click on the numbers, they are hyperlinked to the appropriate page.
Well, who's going to use this, Jim?
So it's a truly an interactive version of the book.
That's what we've tried to create, and it seems to work. It certainly works when I use it.
Have you had feedback? Who's supposed to be using this book?
Well, we think people who travel with any frequency will really enjoy it. If the day is clear, and you have a window seat and it's not too bumpy, you will be able to follow your route across the country or up and down the coast, and the book should help you to understand what you're seeing and give you something to think about.
Okay, the title now again is America from the Air, A Guide to the Landscape Along Your Route. The authors are James Jackson, who we've been talking to, and Daniel Matthews. And you can access this book for purchase from our website, which is onthemenuradio.com.
And OTM bookshelf, and I know it's there because I put it there.
Okay. And also, do you have any other web information that readers should or listeners should know, Jim?
Well, I think we're going to put a web page together on this eventually, but we haven't done it yet, and it may be a while before we have that coordinated.
Well, at the moment, I guess anyway, until they get internet on airplanes, the CD was the best compromise you could come up with.
That's right. That's right.
Now, has anybody ever done anything like this before?
Well, I think the closest thing to this are maps which were published by something called the American Association of Petroleum Geologists. And these are highway maps, and they're on a highway map scale. And on one side of the map, there will be a geological map as compiled by the U.S. Geological Survey with most of the major highways. And then on the back of that map, depending on which part of the region, which part of the country it's in, there are supplementary information. But, you know, that map is really for geologists. It doesn't give you any history, and we try to do that. It certainly doesn't tell you much about land practice or, you know, how cities were developed. And we wanted to get into those topics as well.
Well, you did a fabulous job.
Yeah,
and I understand you do have your little hammer with you. You're en route by land to Portland, right?
We're driving up to Portland. There are snow in the mountains, and it's going to be interesting to see if the highway remains open. We're getting conflicting reports over the radio.
Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
I have to tell you, listeners, for those of you who skipped geography class, or those of you who are in college these days and there isn't even a geography class available, here's a way of learning some of the fascinating history of the Earth that Jim and his co-author absolutely bring to life. I mean, I learned some new things about how some of the landforms that I was familiar with actually really did develop versus the concepts that I learned about them. It's really a way of getting into a subject area that you might have missed, and if you're at all like me, I'm sure you will really derive a great deal of enjoyment and satisfaction, and it'll give you something else to do while you're on the plane. I was on a plane the other day, and they were playing the other Santa Claus, and then the movie on the way back was Unaccompanied Minors, neither of which I wanted to watch. So I wished I'd brought this book with me, and I hope when you take it, you'll feel the same way. Jim, any last thoughts for our listeners?
Well, one thing we need to do on airplanes is to get the staff to tell us where we are going. When I started flying, it was with my family. My parents would fly us from New York to Kansas City to visit my grandparents. My father and I would sit at the wing or at the window, and we would look out. And he would point things out to me. He would say, "There's the Gettysburg battlefield," and he would say, "Look at the ridges, look at the valleys. You can see how the troops had to come up the valleys and they wouldn't know where the other army is." And, you know, then we get over the Ohio River and he'd point out the various steel mills which were operating in those days. And, you know,
Weren't you lucky?
I was. He really had an interest in this, and he really liked it. Helped me see the world as it is. And in those days, before the flight left, the pilot would tell you where you were going to go. And
Sometimes you do, I guess.
Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't, but it's not routine. And typically when you get information from the people up front, it's the older crew who are doing it. The younger crew have come into the airline industry in a period of labor unrest. And the kind of service that was once thought really appropriate for airline travel is no longer provided.
Right. But I guess, Jim, maybe we better not go there.
Better not go there.
I sort of get the message.
Yeah,
curious enough, you and I have quite another piece in common, because I traveled as a child, but it was mostly by train and bus, with a stepfather who was as interested in geography as your father was. So I think my fascination with the subject came from that, and it sounds like yours did too. And as a personal piece of commentary, I think the fact that geography is no longer taught as effectively as it should be in schools and is not taught at all in colleges is a national disgrace, and it's why the majority of people in the United States think that Canada is the 51st state. And that's enough for me being on my pulpit for the day. It's time to say goodbye to Jim, wish him a good day and a wonderful journey where he's headed. We wish we were with him except for the snow. And now I think it's time to say goodbye to Jim and to say it's time to
take a break.
So we'll do that. Bye, Jim.
Bye, and bye, Peter.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
You're sounding a little subdued there, dear.
Oh, I am.
Usually bounce back after a break. There you go. I got
being serious because I'm talking to a man about knives.
Well, it's a good thing. It's a good thing to be careful about when you have a man who packs knives and knows how to take care of them.
Right. We have Peter Hertzman, who, you're my newest best friend, Peter, because you know all about knives, and I think I must have been a samurai in a different life. Hello?
Oh,
Peter.
I'm here.
Hello, are you there, Peter?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good. Your book is called Knife Skills Illustrated, a user's manual, which people listening might find kind of amusing since you can't see any of the illustrations. But the book is so lucid, Peter can walk us through most of what he's talking about. And it's such a rational presentation. Tell us why you wrote this book.
I wrote the book mainly, actually I should back up. I didn't plan to write the book. I wrote an article on my website on how to use knives because I teach knife classes and people always needed something to take away from it. So I decided to write this article on my website, which I've been publishing now for 8 or 9 years. So,
do you want to give us that address?
It's real simple. It's hertzmann.com, hertzmann.com.
Great.
And do people sometimes contact you and try to rent cars from you?
Actually, I believe Hertz's name was Hertzberg, not Hertzman.
Oh, okay.
So I wrote this, and I wrote this article in February 2005. A literary agent in New York City saw it and said, "My, that'd make a great book." And he called me up and tried to convince me of that, and I thought, you know, I had better things to do with my time. But he eventually convinced me, and we turned it into a book. So I didn't set out to do it, but here it is.
Well, I started by saying that it's very logical. You start at the beginning and take us all through. Do you want to tell us how it's organized?
He doesn't start with the most fundamental thing, which is a thing that I have trouble with, which is how to stop from turning the knife on yourself as a weapon.
Well, he does talk about that.
You do that a little bit, but to me, if there was a chapter zero, it would be the chapter that says, here's how you get organized so you have a reduced likelihood to cut yourself.
Well, but I do actually get into that, but not maybe as direct as you would think. Holding a knife is part of that, and how you hold the food is the other part of that. So using, as an example, with a chef's knife, a pinch grip where you're holding a knife between your thumb and your index finger, where you hold the blade right in front of the bolster where the handle ends, and you wrap your other three fingers just loosely around the handle. When you hold the knife that way, it's much more stable than if you hold it like a sword or what you see some people do where they hold it and they put their index finger down the spine of the blade, which then when they press, they have a tendency to press it to one side or the other. Also, if you do that for a long time, I wouldn't be surprised to develop a tendonitis in that finger just from the force on it. But if you're holding a pinch grip with your right hand, and then with your left hand, rather than use the claw that a lot of people talk about or, you know, try to keep that hand totally out of the way, what I do is actually use the flat portion of the first joint of my index finger. You know, we got that nail, that nice hard nail, up flat against the blade. So when I'm using that as a guide for the blade, I always know where the blade is. And when I'm actually cutting, when I move, let's say I'm just cutting something simple like some green onions, essentially slicing little eighth-inch sections of it, what I do is after I've started the cut, I then move my finger back an eighth of an inch, and then when I bring the knife back up, I push it against the finger and start the next cut. And actually, it's been amazing. I've been teaching classes for a long time, a lot of demos, things like that. And no one's ever cut themselves.
Wow.
Now, how did you learn how to do this in the first place?
Well, the pinch grip I learned from Martin Yan years ago. And the what to do with your holding hand was on a, I just sort of came up with myself over time. I always had I have big hands and are a little bit arthritic, and I always had problems holding things in this claw that people talked about. It was like my hand would cramp up, and I started to think about it. It was one of those things where it was like a solution to a problem that wasn't there. People wanted to come up with a way to keep your fingers out of the way, and what I realized was that you want your fingers right up against the blade so you know where they are. That doesn't mean they're underneath the edge, but they're against the side of the blade.
Well, when people buy this book, Peter, they get a whole bunch of information, so it's the kind of book that you're going to keep around and refer to quite a lot. You talk about how knives work, knife anatomy, what to look for, the cutting boards, and that's all before you even get into how you're supposed to hold it.
Well, you need a little theory before you do the practice. Essentially, the book is divided into three portions. The first portion is, like you're saying, it's all the introductory material. Those things that people have a tendency to skip by and just go straight to the meat of the article. But really is important things to at least get a little bit of handle on. And that's the only part that I ever suggest to anybody sit down and read, cover to cover, so to say. At least, that whole 30 pages or so. The second section is the cutting of fruits and vegetables.
What impressed me was your analysis of the celery root.
Well, what you need to do is before you cut anything, you have to look at it.
Yeah, pretty threatening.
every vegetable, you take apart talking about celery root, which a lot of people maybe haven't seen, but, head of celery, which has all these stalks on it, every stalk is different. Mm-hmm. So you can't cut each one exactly the same way. Every onion, even if you pick onions which on the outside look like they're exactly the same size, if you start to look at them, you'll see that they're not all perfectly round, slightly different shapes. As you peel them, you'll see the layers are a little different thicknesses. And so there isn't just one way to do things. You have to sort of look at it, and after a while, with practice, you develop an eye for how each vegetable, or in case of meats also, how different cuts of meats are. You develop an eye for it so you know where the dotted lines are and where to cut.
So the book was, after that first section, was really intended as sort of like a reference book. So if I want to know how to cut an avocado, I pick it up and go to that section. Or if I want to know how to debone a chicken, I go to a different section. Was that the idea?
That's the idea. And I would think that if somebody goes through, a third of the book and does the various techniques, that they may not even need the rest, that they'll figure those out on their own.
Okay, in much the same way as you did yourself, I guess.
Yeah. You develop, there's a couple things. It's, developing how to look at things. It's also developing muscle memory, which for a lot of people means unlearning previous muscle memory. How when you pick up the knife, do you grip it the right way from the start? Learning that is a really important thing. It's difficult for some people early on. And in the knife skills classes, it's not uncommon for someone to struggle for the first two-thirds of the class with that grip. And then all of a sudden, something will kick in, and they'll get it, and things will just start flowing.
Now, you teach classes at Sur La Table and other places too?
Yeah, I taught some in Canada in September. Have one coming up in New York City in January.
How long are these classes?
It depends on how the class organizers set them up. They can be anywhere from an hour to 3 hours.
Hey, you remember that book about the sushi restaurant in California that we got? I forget the name of the book now, but there was this... one of the members of this class in a sushi academy somewhere in Southern California, and it's a whole story about how she just couldn't learn how to cut things quite right, and you always thought she was going to fail, and then right at the end she was successful, but she used to cheat on and not sharpen her knives like she was supposed to, so she made all the common mistakes that people make, all of which you anticipate in the wonderful way in which you write this book.
Thank you.
Now, here's another one that's a daunting task, and I just had to do this 2 days in a row, is cutting ginger.
Why is that daunting?
Where do you start? I mean, all these little knobs.
Well, I usually start by peeling it. Now,
that's sort of like the hard part. he's getting all those little inside out angles.
Well, you're using a peeler in this one illustration.
Sure, use the best tool. I can do it with a knife, a small paring knife. I can use a peeler. I've had people tell me I have to use a spoon. I'm not a big fan of using a spoon for peeling ginger.
Oh heavens, no!
It tends to spray juice all over the place. Plus, it's just something else to wash.
Have you tried that, the perfect peeler that goes at different angles? It's Kyocera.
I may have. I don't remember. I'm real partial on these real inexpensive ones from Switzerland that cost like $4 and last a lifetime.
And what are they called?
The brand is Kuhn, K-U-H-N, but I've seen them all over.
Oh, a Kuhn Rikon.
Okay. Could be. It's a little plastic handle peeler, costs $4.
Okay. Well, they have one that I never realized you have all those angles. It's really good. And you can turn it to vertical and.
Oh, that type. Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
It's really cool.
I've been lucky to be able to turn it, the peeler itself without having to worry about the complexity of a little knob. I peel a lot of different things. Now, getting back to ginger. Part of it's going to depend on what you're going to do with that ginger. If you're planning to shred it, those little knobs are going to get in the way, so I actually just cut them off. Ginger is, for the amount you use, is a very inexpensive product. If I'm going to grate it, which I use a microplane for nowadays, I used to use a Japanese ginger grater, but I found a microplane that's much faster and works beautifully, then I'll often peel the knobs, but I'll take them off and grate them separately. I don't waste anything that way.
Yeah, so that's a clever thing. So you do like a two-stage process.
Mm-hmm.
First cut it up gross and then take it further from there.
What's the hardest thing you've ever had to cut and slice?
The hardest thing?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I would say that, that it's not what was, it's not what I had to cut, it's what I had to cut it with.
Oh, that's clever. Uh-huh. And what was it?
I've been in some restaurants where, the knife, because when I like go to Europe and work in restaurants, I don't take my knives with me. So I'm using what's there. And it's tough, when you get a dull knife and you got a lot of, I don't care, even if it's just onions.
Even onions. Onions especially, yeah. Onions are bad with a dull knife. What about, I'm not sure about your pineapple cutting technique. I experiment with different techniques all the time. What's your favorite?
Well, once again, it depends on what you're going to do with it. If you're going to make little, wedges that you can stick toothpicks in, sort of thing, for a party, then I just take the crown off and the base, cut those, across. Then I start sectioning it from the top down. You cut in half, then quarters, and you cut those into usually three sections. You'll have on each one of those wedge-shaped pieces a piece of the core, so you lay that wedge-shaped piece down flat and take the core off with the knife. And then you take that wedge, so you have a flat-top wedge, you got skin on the bottom, and you can go one of two ways about it. You can either cut them horizontally and then vertically, or vertically and horizontally. What I generally do is I'll make horizontal cuts just to the skin, and often I'll use a smaller knife for that so I don't, press as hard. Maybe a half inch apart. And then I come across with the knife horizontal, and just holding down on the top of the wedge, I'll just carefully cut horizontally right above the skin, and so they stay on the skin. And then you can set it out on the plate, that way.
Hmm. Yeah, what do you think of those cores?
Oh, that's one you push through?
Yeah, I've never tried one.
Well, my problem with that core is one size.
See, that's why I never bought one.
And the cores in pineapples vary in size, and some are not totally straight and not always in the center.
You remember the story
of the product with that.
Yeah, Peter's about to. I was thinking of this too. I wasn't sure I was going to mention it.
The story of the avocado pitter. Somebody sent us this avocado pitter, which was essential to the process of cutting an avocado. And we actually had avocados in the studio, and we were trying to do this live. And we're getting this avocado pitter and applying it to the end of the avocado and then pushing it all the way through the skin. And he made it a most atrocious mess. And so we asked the person who sent us the product, you know, what, wasn't it defective? And she said, oh, well, you were doing it the wrong way. The first thing you do is cut the artichoke, cut the avocado in half.
But they never said that.
But we said, well, but once you've done that, what do you need an avocado pitter for?
I'm not sure that was that wasn't Cyril Latable, I hope.
it was somebody who actually produced the device for. We succeeded in pushing this avocado pitter all the way through from the skinny end to the thick end. took an entire core out of the center of the avocado, pit and all. But it made the most. You needed to be really strong, and it made the most appalling mess.
But somebody made a big gaffe by not printing on the labels. First cut it in half.
First slaughter your ox, right? This is beaten.
Yeah, exactly. Now, one more thing I need to mention here is you talk about Peter's being thorough. Not only does he walk you through all of this right-handed, but he does the same thing left-handed.
Now, I asked Anne, what's the difference? I mean, what's the difference between a left-handed and a right-handed knife? And Anne tried to show me.
I tried to show you with scissors.
She didn't do a good job of explaining it. Perhaps you can try.
Well, in European-style knives are knives available in America. They're good for, the knife itself is good for left or right-handed people. In Japan, where they have knives which are beveled only on one side, then if the bevel's on the right side, it's for somebody who's right-handed, and if you're left-handed, you usually have to special order knives, or there's a couple that are available for left-handed folks.
Yeah. Somebody gave us a left-handed bread knife, and we were trying to think of somebody to give it to, because we don't know anybody around here who really cuts their own bread. And then I had this wonderful magic thought that my sister is a repressed left-hander who became a left-hander, and they eat lots of bread. So
a common, you know, a serrated knife generally is only beveled on one side. It's only ground on one side.
Okay, so you have to have it on the right.
They tend to be, but they come on both sides, and you'll find that left-handed, right-handed people can use the same serrated knives generally. It's much different than what's happening with some of the...
Scissors are a totally different thing. I mean...
Yeah, scissors are different because of the angle in which the thumb and forefinger go through the slots.
Right.
That's what Anne was showing me. But your explanation is very logical, and just like everything that you outline in the book is very logical. Listeners, this book is called, again...
Knife Skills Illustrated, a User Manual, and it's by Peter Hertzman. And go also to his website, which is Peter
Hertzman.com. Well, an easy way, the website is called A La Carte, and if you Google the term A La Carte, it will be right up there at the top of the list.
That's great.
There we go. Or they can go straight to Hertzman.com, and you have a newsletter there and all kinds of good stuff.
Well, this has been a pleasure. And I hope people stock this book so we have fewer accidents in the kitchen.
I'm gonna have to read this book from cover to cover, because I'm guilty.
Absolutely
hopeless. When I start chopping the, we couldn't have a vegetarian meal in our household because there'd always be a little Peter in every dish. You never thought about that, did you?
I don't want to think about it. Thank you. Well, Peter, thank you for calling us.
Yeah, the Peters have it today. We outnumbered the Anns.
Okay, so well, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us, and have a wonderful holiday season, if there's still any of it left by the time we put this on the program.
Okay.
Thanks,
bye, Peter.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that's it, listeners. That's the first program for 2008. We're delighted that you joined us. We hope that you'll be with us throughout the year, and you'll join us again next week at onthemenuradio.com.